For those of you who don't know me, we can introduce you. I'm Dr. Michael Gorin. I'm a medical retina and ophthalmic genetics specialist. And I'm a student at UCLA. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity and the privilege, actually, of speaking to you all today. I will apologize in advance that my slides are not very visual. And I do that intentionally because when I am given this privilege to speak to people in the public about macular degeneration or other hereditary retinal diseases, I usually have people in the audience who do not have, let's say, very good sight. And so I don't ever want them to feel that they're going to miss something by having slides that require them to see real clearly. So really this is an audio talk more than anything else, and the slides are sort of a bit of reference. There will be time for questions for me right after my talk, but we'll keep that very short so that Dr. Klassen can do his presentation, and then we'll have additional questions at the end. So what do you need to know about macular degeneration? Well, you've already had a lecture about what is age-related macular degeneration. Of course, one question that comes up, and I should say at the beginning that my goal here is not to all make you scientists, nor to presume that you know all about science, but to really put it in a perspective for you, to really answer the key questions that you have, which is, what's going to happen, what's being done to help me or my family with this condition? So you've already had some discussion about age-related macular degeneration. Is it one disease or many? Well, this has been actually a subject of tremendous debate. People had thought for a long time that because of the changes in the eye, maybe this represented multiple different pathways of disease culminating in a similar looking process. We now know from the genetic studies that to a large extent, while the genetics is complex, it's pointing to the fact that there are common mechanisms that unite all the different forms of AMD at this time. Now, you heard me actually at the end of the last speaker talk about associations, and what do we really mean when we talk about associations, risk factors, and causes? We have to be very clear about this. This leads to a lot of confusion for people. As I said before, when we do population-based studies and we're doing comparisons of one group to another, we often find that there are differences. And so if you find that a group, for example, are older, that may be a factor as to why they have more of the disease. Or as we talked about smoking and diet, lots of the evidence that's based on the benefits of lutein, for example, have really been based on epidemiologic studies. Only now is a controlled clinical study going on to really ask the question, if I give you lutein, will it change your risk? You have to understand that the studies today have not really established an answer to that, and it's an important question. All they have shown, and it's pretty compelling, that those who have a higher intake of lutein and zeaxanthin, those macular carotenoids they refer to, have an association with a lower prevalence of AMD. In terms of risk factors, when we mean this, if you modify that factor, or if you know that you have that factor versus another, it alters your risk. So the first is just connection. The second says that there's a risk involvement. For example, smoking is pretty conclusively agreed upon now as to be a risk factor for macular degeneration. It increases the risk about 2.5-fold. As we'll talk about, there are genetic variants that also increase your risk. And we believe that these are not simply associations anymore, but now we have the scientific evidence to make a compelling argument that these variations in some way are affecting a pathway that's critical to the cause of macular degeneration. However, the variation itself may not be causal. It may be, again, an association. So we still have a bit of a ways to go. But again, when we talk about risk factors, it doesn't always mean that it causes the disease. And finally, when we talk about cause, we're really at the bottom of the system. This is what truly triggers it. And we're getting there with macular degeneration. I can tell you, I've been doing macular degeneration research now for close to 30 years. And the advances in the last 5 years are unbelievable, absolutely explosive. And I'm proud to say that a lot of that has to do with the work that was done in genetics. So a lot of biology studies and cellular studies and studies of the patients and tissues with macular degeneration have added to it all. We couldn't make that connection until we had the genetics. So the genetic studies that I'm referring to in this slide, both family and case control, we started out looking at families, people who had other family members with macular degeneration who had macular degeneration themselves. And because it's a late onset condition, we looked at basically brothers and sisters, because the parents are usually gone. I mean, when a person's 65, very often their parents are not still alive. But when we did those studies, well, that took us a good 20 years, 17 years actually, we found that there were areas of the genetic information in people's cells that was associated, couldn't say it was causal, associated with macular degeneration. Now, subsequently, studying those areas very intensively by newer methods, and also adding in looking at people who had no family history of macular degeneration versus those who had no disease at all, we in fact have found several different genes in those regions that cause, or we feel now, are causal and do strongly contribute to risk. I'm often asked, well, is the cause of macular degeneration different in someone who has a family history versus somebody who walks in and who doesn't? It's a good question. The answer is probably not. Because there are so many different genes and variants that contribute to risk, what we have found so far is that those with a family history are pretty much have the same risk factors as those who don't have a family history. It's just the combination that occurs. And of course, smoking and other risk factors. So far, we haven't found that families are worse off, in a sense, than those who are not. Just to give you an idea, this graph, I do this to show you when I tell you that there's been an explosion in 5 years. You can see that I started collecting families, God, it was a long time ago, about 1990. I'm getting on. And you can see that the first, on the slide, it shows the first linkage study was done, was published by us in about 2000. And you can see that there were a few papers. This is just looking at numbers of publications on genetics. And you can see by 2007 that the number had gone, it's gone exponentially. And by the way, now it's up into the thousands. Each year, more and more groups are studying the genetics. And in a sense, that has become a strong foundation for the research that's going on, but it's not the end point. All the genetics can do, it allows us to look at variations in genes that affect your people's risk for having disease. It remains to the basic scientists to take those discoveries and translate that into understanding the biology so that we can come up with new medications, which you've heard about a little bit in the previous talk, or come up with other strategies to reduce the disease. So one of the questions, of course, is, and I'm trying to get at this, people say to me, well, what is the goal of all this research? Well, our goals are pretty simple. We want to prevent the disease, we want to halt its progression, and we want to restore sight for those who've lost it. Right? Pretty much, I think we're all in agreement, that's where we want to go. So what about prevention? What are the issues that we have to deal with? Well, for one, are we talking about preventive therapies for everybody? I mean, should we all be wearing blue blockers? Should we all be taking extra lutein and zeaxanthin? Of course, I think we would agree that all of us shouldn't smoke, but that's for other reasons as well. If I came up with a pill that lowered your risk, I guess it would depend on how safe the pill was and how much it cost, depending on who would want to take it. If you had a very low risk of disease, we could bankrupt you, perhaps, if you were taking it for a whole lifetime. So one of the questions we have that is sort of a little bit outside of the research area, but one that we always have to think about is, to what extent should the cost and risk of a preventive therapy affect the decision as to who should be treated? And we're going to get back to this topic again, because one of the things that's coming out now, and it's available to you today, is to be tested for your genetic risk for macular degeneration. And what I want to point out to you is that maybe we're not there yet for that testing to be done. So in terms of identifying those who are at risk for genetic disease, we have to consider, or for macular degeneration, we have to consider genetic testing. We have to consider that environmental exposure, such as smoking and behavior, like exercise and things, and try to establish which ones are associations and which ones are truly risk factors. So first of all, how good are the current genetic methods? We've now identified roughly 8 genes and variants in those genes that contribute substantially to the risk of macular degeneration. How much is that variation in risk? About 300 to 500 fold between those who have very low risk and those who have very high risk. If you look at those people who have the lowest risk genetically for macular degeneration, almost none of them get macular degeneration. Great for them. Cool. And those with the highest risk factors, over 90% of them, maybe even higher, get macular degeneration. Tough luck. But the problem is, most of us are in the middle. Most of us have some risk factors, some genetic risk factors, and others that may even be protective. So for those of us in the middle, the genetic testing is not going to be very good at deciding whether you're really going to get macular degeneration or not. Okay? This just shows from some of the early work, just to show you the range. And what I'm trying to point out here is those with the lowest risk are way down here, and those with the highest risk are way up here. But the population is all sitting in here. Very, very few people at both ends of the spectrum. In fact, we spend a lot of our time trying to find people at the extremes. Those who have very low risk who still get macular degeneration, and those who have very high risk who do not. And they're so few in both groups that it's very, very difficult. So this was a paper that just came out about 2 months ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy. And just to show you the combined risk, where they combined all of the major risks, this is their model for doing this. And by the way, I need to point out, there are different models for calculating how these different genetic risk factors contribute to your overall risk. So for example, if you buy, and you can, as I said, you can do this now, if you want to go and purchase a genetic test of your blood to look at what your risk is for AMD, and you went to 3 different companies, even if they tested the same variations in your genes and got the same answers, they'll give you different risks. They'll tell you a different answer because they use different models. So as much as I like, you know, the genetics and the modeling, we have to recognize that there are real limitations. Now, this is a little bit technical here, but what it's trying to get at the point is that when we do genetic research and we find a strong association of a variant with a gene, and the one that's most known is complement factor H, by the way, if you haven't heard of that one, it has a huge impact on your risk for the disease. But as a clinical test, you have to know, how often am I going to falsely identify somebody as going to get the disease? And how often am I going to miss somebody who's going to get the disease because of my test? And these are just ways of doing it. And what we've done, this is from one of my papers, where what we've done is we've actually looked at the real genetic data that's out there and asked, how good is it going to be if we were to do it as a clinical test? And what we found is that, well, the bottom line is, it's not very good. How so? Well, to correctly identify 3/4 of the cases, so if I had a bunch of people coming in and I said, okay, I'm going to test them all, I'm going to have 1,000 people, I'm going to test them. In order to identify 3/4 of those who will ultimately get macular degeneration, I'm going to wrongly classify 31% of the people who will never get macular degeneration. Okay? That's pretty high because most people don't develop macular degeneration, even at advanced age. I mean, at the worst times of your life, when you're in your 80s, it's about 25 to maybe 30% to have macular degeneration. So what that means is, just to summarize very quickly, if we did this, we would only be able to predict about 12% of the people correctly. That's not a good test, okay? So in other words, I get this test out, and I would only be correct 12% of the time. Now, if I'm doing a clinical study, like you heard about before, where, you know, we want people who are at risk for macular degeneration, we can basically double the risk of the group so we can more quickly and use less people get to an answer. But for a person, I don't think it's right to alarm 88% of the people that they're going to have macular degeneration. Now, some of my colleagues in ophthalmology say, well, but I want to really convince my patients to stop smoking and to take lutein and to take vitamins. As a geneticist, I have to tell you, I do not believe in genetic coercion. Okay. So I think that this is not what we should be doing at this time. As you see, I've even just reiterated this. The other thing that we have to understand as we've been doing this, can any preventive measures reduce our degree of risk? Well, that's an important question. Okay, if I have increased genetic risk factors, well, am I just screwed? Is there nothing that can be done? Well, again, we don't have great studies on this yet, but there is one epidemiologic study that suggests that if you take people who are at higher risk and you have them do the preventive therapies that we talk about, not smoke, take lutein, zeaxanthine, take the ARED supplements, that they do reduce their risk. They don't reduce it to zero, but they can get it almost down to the population-based risk. So they can get down to about the same risk as anybody else. So the point is that you're never probably going to have prevention measures that are going to eliminate the risk completely. Because those people at the real top of the ladder, nothing ain't going to help them. And if the people at the bottom, obviously, they don't need it. But for those of us in the middle, we may be able to get a little bit of movement in terms of our risk. Why do I say this? Well, because, again, it's this guilt issue. If you're, you know, there's this thing like, well, if you don't do the right thing, you know, that's why you got macular degeneration. No. You could do the right thing for your entire life, and some people will still get it. Okay. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do the right thing, but you shouldn't necessarily make somebody feel guilty that because they didn't do it, that's why they got the disease. The last point I want to make is prevention therapy the same as treatment approach to halt progression? We believe now that macular degeneration, as I said, is a complex condition. There are multiple factors involved. So prevention is really a matter of trying to reduce risk, but you're not going to ever totally prevent it. Treatment approach to halt progression is to deal with those who already have the disease, you're sure they have it, and you want to not have it progress or get worse. And in many respects, that's a little bit different. Now, you already heard about the current treatments with anti-VEGF drugs, Avastin and Lucentis. It does not really stop the progression of the underlying disease. In other words, when we give Lucentis and it's working, all it does is it stops that abnormal blood vessel, that choroidal neovascularization you heard about, from growing. It doesn't stop the process that caused it to grow in the first place. So it really isn't even halting or slowing the progression. The underlying macular degeneration is still occurring. That's perhaps why nutrient supplements, such as the ARED supplements, in fact, have been shown to reduce the rate of progression by about 20%. They're working more on that underlying factor. But again, it's not a cure. The newest approaches are looking at modulating the inflammatory response, and that's because of the genes that we have found involved in macular degeneration, a whole bunch of them are part of the same pathway. This pathway has a name, it's called the alternate complement pathway. That's not so important to you. What's important to know is what that pathway does. That pathway is your guardian. That pathway is a way that your body has of attacking foreign elements that are introduced into the body to prevent infection. Unfortunately, in some people, it's not properly regulated, and it can actually be overactive and attack your own body. And those are people who have autoimmune conditions, like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and others. But we have now found that it is this inflammatory response that, when you alter its regulation, seems to affect the risk of getting macular degeneration. Now you're going to say to me, well, why in the eye? I mean, if it's the body, Why the eye? Well, part of it is that part of the regulation of that complement pathway occurs locally in the eye by the cells under the retina. And part of it has to do with the fact that there's probably a trigger, which is why the previous speaker spoke to you about avoiding blue light, for example. We think that may be activating some molecules to become toxic. It's not proven yet, but there's some pretty good evidence in animal models and in the laboratory that high levels of vitamin A, when they get derivatized, when that molecule is modified and then hit with blue light, can activate this pathway and trigger this inflammatory response that leads to the degeneration in the eye. So these pathways are essential to protect us. But unfortunately, so we have a critical issue. How do we regulate it without endangering the person either way? And by the way, there's some evidence to suggest that it's not all occurring from risk factors in the eye. A good colleague of mine has shown that, or has begun to get data to show that when patients, for example, receive a liver transplant from somebody whose liver has the high genetic risk factors for macular degeneration, it accelerates their development of macular degeneration. And if they get a liver that has the low risk factors, it can actually be somewhat protective. So we know that the whole process isn't just going on in the eye. There are factors going on throughout the body as well. Obviously, I've talked a little bit already about prevention. Who do we give prevention therapy to and what that might be? The same question comes up, at what stage in life should one begin such therapies? Do you do it at the first clinical sign of disease when someone says they have a few little drusen? Or do you do it when they've already got lots of drusen and they're already having some vision changes? I guess that's going to have to depend a little bit on the safety and cost again. Focusing on local control of the inflammatory pathway, this is something that people are talking in terms of gene therapy. Most people think of gene therapy as fixing a broken gene. That is a valid form of gene therapy. But another form of gene therapy is to introduce the production of a molecule that in some way protects the individual or lessens their progression of disease. And certainly, there are people working now on gene therapy methods where they modify not the retina, but the cells under the retina to enhance their ability to suppress that inflammation activation and to protect them. Certainly, one thing is that we want to focus more on the trigger of that inflammatory process, and that still is not known. There may be several different ones still, but this is the area right now of the most intense basic research. This is what's going on as we speak. Well, Saturday. And I bet some people are working. If you were going to try to treat it, you would require sustained delivery of a drug or a protein molecule. That's why gene therapy would be so nice. If you can modify the cells to produce it on an ongoing basis, you don't have to keep giving the person shots or drops or pills. But realize that, again, this has both a systemic, a body-wide component, as well as an eye component. And of course, one thing that we have to consider, you heard a little bit about things being injected into the eye, little encapsulated devices, whether we should be injecting things under your retina. This is also going to be dependent on also the risk of doing those interventions, because some people will have complications. Now, the other area of research, again, which is the focus of many people's interest, is restorative treatment. So we talked about prevention, we talked about halting progression, and now we're talking about restoration. So what's the goal of restoration? Well, it's to restore usable sight to those who've lost it from macular degeneration. Now, either we have to replace, in macular degeneration as well as many other retinal diseases, you lose sight because cells die. That seems obvious. But actually, for example, there are some rare cases where you may have read, did any of you hear about the gene therapy that was successful in Pennsylvania and in England?
LCA.
Yeah, LCA. Leber's congenital amaurosis. For one particular type of Leber's congenital amaurosis. In that particular, that was a brilliant case of gene therapy where they introduced the gene that was defective in those individuals and they could see. That sounds restorative, and it is. But what makes it unique is that the particular genetic defect in those children and adults for that particular condition causes the cells in the retina to be blind before they die. So if you do gene therapy for them, you can restore the sight of the cells that are still alive. If you wait a long time, you don't get complete restoration of vision because they've lost cells, and we don't have the ability to raise cells from the dead yet. How are we going to restore vision if cells are dying? Macular degeneration, cells die. Why do people get better after injections for wet macular degeneration? Because as you suppress that vessel and the retina flattens back down and it restores its function, those cells haven't died and the person's able to restore their sight. If it's gone on too long and the cells in the retina have started to die, well, the injections may be successful, your retina may look great, but you won't see so well. So the approaches, and Dr. Klassen is going to talk about stem cell work, but there are several approaches. Stem cells, introducing cells that can divide and change themselves to rebuild the tissue. Cell transplantation, this is where they actually grow the tissue and transplant it in, they've tried that. And actually there are several groups that are trying to convert the surviving cells. You know, your retina doesn't completely die when you have macular degeneration or these retinal diseases, only certain populations of cells. What if we could take the cells that are still alive in your retina and convert them so they can see? And there are people working on this. There are ways that we can introduce genes that add a critical protein into a cell that makes it respond to light. So research is going on in that area. And I think many of you have heard about bioelectronic devices. These are the artificial retinas and this sort of thing. The challenge with these these electronic retinas is that they have the difficulty of, as you try to get higher and higher resolution, that is, as you want to have more electrodes, you have to focus in on things. It gets harder and harder to not have it kill the cells. I'll do that. So, I just want to point out that with stem cell and cell transplantation, I want you to appreciate the fact that it's much more like a reconstruction project rather than new building. Okay? You have the situation where you have to remove the damage and get the cells reoriented again, not simply replace the cells that are there. We have a long way to go in this. It is an incredibly exciting time. We have made enormous advances in just a few years. When you read in the New York Times that the Genome Project has not yielded much in results yet, let me just tell you that in the field of macular degeneration, we are not only the head of the curve, we are leading the way with the rest of the world in research for diseases in general in terms of exploiting the benefits of that program. So with that, I'll conclude, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yeah, I can stay after Dr. Klassen.
Yeah, why don't we do it after Dr. Klassen, and we can actually stay in that 10-minute break, too.
That's fine.
We can handle one question while Dr. Klassen is setting himself up. Yes, ma'am.
We have a sister who's had wet macular degeneration for several years. Is there any therapy for her other than
the injections?
Therapy, yes. She decided there's nothing that she can do. Is there?
Well, first of all, I'm going to put on a different hat here and say there's always something we can do for someone with macular degeneration. Okay? It may not be restoring their sight, but there are certain things we can always do to improve their quality of life and give them greater independence. And so, first and foremost, let's not lose sight of that. Secondly, the biggest barrier for people to function with macular degeneration is depression, not just their vision loss. So if you have a person who's really in despair because they can't see, we need to treat the despair. But finally,
move you out of the way so he can get his.
In terms of treatments, right now the anti-VEGF therapies, Avastin, Lucentis, are by far the best bet. There are people trying combination therapies that were mentioned before to try to reduce the number of injections, but none of them are really stopping the underlying disease. So the answer to your question is, in one sense, no, and in another sense, yes.
Thank you.
Go ahead, I'll take one.
It seems like, and part of the problem that people that suffer from macular degeneration is that they accumulate a lot of drusen into the eye. And if you focus on that particular aspect of...
Well, actually, we are. We used to think...
I didn't finish my question.
Go ahead.
If you focus down, that sort of a problem, and there are new OCTs that are available that allows you to measure better, can't you then cut down, partition this problem and focus on that area so we could get an improvement just in that area and improve the whole probability?
Well, you know, I'll
do it in 30 seconds. Yeah.
But basically, we used to think drusen were just garbage collecting in the back of the eye. We now know that those are the areas where you're getting activation of this inflammatory pathway. So all of this research on controlling the inflammatory pathway is really directed exactly to what you're talking about, preventing the buildup of that material in those deposits. So yes, we are doing that, and we're doing it at the basic biological level, but that's exactly what we're trying to do.